You can love seafood and know almost nothing about how it is procured. Well, that will change in the balance of this hour. Our guest knows a great deal about seafood and bringing it in sustainably, and he shares at least some of his knowledge in a snappy new book called The Sea Forager's Guide to the Northern California Coast, written by Kirk Lombard and illustrated by Leighton Kelly. Kirk Lombard says he teaches, writes, fishes, sings, and plays tuba in a band. He spent 7 years as a fisheries observer for the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission. Kirk and his wife Camilla are the co-founders of Sea Forager in San Francisco, which is in the seafood business, but also gives fishing and foraging classes. Kirk, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Well, thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
Was there anything quite like Sea Forager when you started the business?
I'm sorry, didn't quite hear that. Say that again.
Was there anything quite like Sea Forager when you started the business?
No, I think there still isn't, really. As far as the sort of the walking tours aspect and the educational stuff, not to my knowledge. There are several CSFs, sort of in this area anyway, that deliver sustainable seafood around the city, which is what my main gig is right now. But as far as like the walking tours and sort of the educational stuff that I do, I don't think anyone is doing that.
So the CSF functions like a CSA, a community supported agriculture thing, and you just essentially order in advance.
Yeah, it's a subscription service, and it tends to the people that sign up for it tend to have been either fans of my blog. I used to have a blog back in the day. Before I had kids and I stopped doing all the things I used to do for free, I had a blog, and it was called the Monkey Face News, and it was kind of about, oh, some of the weird creatures of the California coast and the eccentric people who pursue them. And so a lot of the fans of that blog ended up signing up for my seafood subscription service, and then the people who have done my tours. So I'd say probably at least half of my subscriber base is sort of my fan base too, as it were.
So, well, now you've managed to find a way to combine your talents and skills. Then, I mean, so you're good at catching fish, you're good at doing some outreach, and you pulled them all together. It sounds like with Sea Forager.
You know, I think I'm actually better at the outreach. I'm better at the telling of the story. That's the thing that really resonates with me, and I think that's why I've had some success getting an audience. As far as fishing, I've always sort of targeted the sort of underappreciated species in our area, and so it's not like the most lucrative thing that way. But that's where my passion lies. So those are the types of things that I tend to catch, and so there was sort of a focus on that in the book.
Now, I noticed the book has been getting some good reviews, including from Field and Stream, which called you a divinely inspired whack job. Is that a badge of honor?
Yeah, I like that. That's gonna go on my. I think that's gonna go on my tombstone.
Divinely inspired whack job. Yeah, that'd be a good thing to have. Yeah. Well, you start us off with a short quiz, and darn, we have to think about ourselves and our own behavior right off the bat in the book. Whether we want to be consumers or citizens, lay out the differences, would you?
Well, I think I just put that in the beginning, you know, because you're talking about foraging and fishing along the coast, and I think. You know, sometimes there's this, we have a tendency to treat everything as if it's always going to be there, as if it's, as if there's just no end to the bounty. And I just really want people to focus on how amazing it is that we have such, wonderful abundance on our coast, and to not always just think in terms of, whether it's legal. You want to think in terms of whether it's ethical. So in our area, you know, we have certain things like we have limpets, right? And people like to eat limpets. But is it really ethical to follow the rules on that? Because, you know, it's 35 per person. And so I encourage people to not always feel like the thing that you have to do is limit out in order to have had a good day fishing or foraging. You know, it's take what you need. But... And to try not to be greedy, try not to treat it like you're standing in a safe way, but rather that this is a very finite resource that you're harvesting, and to treat it appropriately. So I put that in the beginning just because I want to get that established right away before people start reading and thinking that, oh, this is just like a book about let's go out and kill stuff. You know, it's not. The onus of this book is on appreciating how beautiful it is. And the book is filled with humorous haikus and anecdotes and little pieces of information that maybe we've overlooked in our passion for seafood. And so I hope that it's also not only an introduction to people who haven't done this stuff, but that there's something in there for the veterans as well. I hope I answered your question.
You did. And I hope you had as much fun writing the book as readers will have with it. And when you come back to talking about not treating, you know, where you're trying to catch your fish as a safe way, what do you make of the way most seafood is taken in the world today, Kirk?
Well, obviously, I think everybody who's interested in this, so potentially anyone who's listening here, has done a little bit of research or has, you know, at least read some of the headlines about the egregious harvesting of seafood around the planet. You know, typically, I'm not as well-versed with the rules and regulations in Oregon, but in California, the rules and regulations governing our coastal resources are just really, really tough and strict, and they should be. And so I always tell people that the first thing to establish is where your seafood was caught. And if it's caught in some distant land where you have no idea what the regulatory processes are, and so you don't know the gear types, you don't know the fishermen, and something's shipped from halfway around the world, it just really, that's a tough call as far as determining exactly how sustainable it is. But if it's in your own backyard, you can look this stuff up. You can look up what the quotas are for coastal fishes up and down the coast and educate yourself and satisfy your desire to have sustainable seafood just by learning more about it.
All right, kind of like knowing your farmer. In this case, you're knowing your fisherman as well. It's called The Sea Forager's Guide to the Northern California Coast. Kirk Lombard, the author and our guest. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Kirk Lombard and you in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Kirk Lombard, the co-founder with his wife Camila of Sea Forager in San Francisco, which not only runs a sustainable or a community-supported fishery in the sense of community-supported agriculture, it's a subscription service for seafood, also gives tours to show people how to catch their own seafood and of all types. Not just the type for carnivores. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the book and the life of Kirk Lombard. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Kirk, I love the fact that you decided to offer an appendix, or actually five, but you call them swim bladders instead of appendices. Why?
Well, you know, there's this mammalian favoritism going on with the word appendices, so I figured we'd go with swim bladder, which is... You know, the appendix is kind of a vestigial organ in the human body of little significance, but the swim bladder is of great significance to a fish, to some fishes that have them, and so I just figured instead of calling them appendices in the back of the book, we'd call them swim bladders.
So let's go right to swim bladder number three, how not to kill yourself out there. What are the general dangers for people seeking seafood? And we're generally talking land-based here, right?
You know, I can speak of this with great expertise because, you know, I get really into it when I'm out there. So like if I'm out smelt dipping, I tend to be the guy that wades out a little bit too deep or, you know, is trying to get the net down in the trough. So I heave it as far as I can, lose my balance. This year I suffered the indignity of, I hooked a nice striper on a local beach near where I live. And, In my exuberance, it had been about a year since I had a nice big striper on a line, you know, something over 14 pounds. And I really, really wanted that fish. And I got it in the swash. It came up behind me in the surf as they do, you know, because you kind of surf the fish up onto the wave when you're plugging for stripers. And it came off. And I made, like, arguably one of the dumbest things I've ever done. I just really didn't want to lose that fish. And I think all fishermen probably have had this moment. But here I am having written this book and having written a chapter called How Not to Kill Yourself Out There. And what did I go and do? I dove on it like a frickin' pelican diving into a school of anchovies. I dove on this fish, got slammed by a wave, grabbed it by the mouth, and pulled it out. But, you know, that kind of behavior is kind of like what I'm trying to tell people. Hey, be really careful. Don't do what I do. I get so into it sometimes I do lose my head. And I just wanted to make sure that maybe somebody who's not quite as athletic as I am or crazy might not have made it out of the wave that day. So I figured that in this case, since I have experience doing crazy things in the surf, I should write a little bit about how crazy it can be and how we can get too focused on trying to get something and forget about the wave behind you or the swell that day. And so I put that in there.
And to give our listeners a sense of just how irreverent the book can get, there's a whole section here where Kirk talks about stuff that he did and died. He's now writing this from the other side. So he's giving me examples all the way through of all the bad things that can happen when you're out. Did you hold on to the striper that day?
So, you know what? You must be a fisherman. Because every single person that I tell that story to, that if it's a fisherman, they say, okay, but did you hang on to the fish?
I wish I were a fisherman. I'm the kind of guy who catches one fish off the side of the boat. The guy on the other side catches seven.
Yeah, well, that's I don't know. Maybe that's good. Maybe you didn't want those seven fish. But the issue is, in fact, I did catch the fish. I got a lucky grab on the lower jaw and pulled him out, brought him home, weighed him, and it was 14 and a half pounds.
So does that mean he was legal or not?
Oh, that's very legal.
Okay, good. All right. So Kirk Lombard managed to stay alive and live to tell the story. He's the author of the Sea Forager's Guide to the Northern California Coast here on the Jefferson Exchange. Some of the other dangers, I mean, can nematodes really bore out of our stomachs, or is that just the long-term possibility?
Oh, yeah, they sure can. Yeah, they can bore right through your stomach, certain types of parasitic worms, or they can burrow into your stomach lining, and that's painful in and of itself. But generally speaking, the fish that that have the nematodes, most people are cooking those fish, and the cooking process kills the. We're talking about larval roundworms or roundworms. Okay. We'll talk about nematodes. Most fish have parasites, and if you cook them. And you kill the parasites, but a lot of people like to eat their fish raw. So for those who like to eat their fish raw, you might want to consider candling your fish, which is what sushi chefs are supposed to do. They don't all do it, but a sushi chef is supposed to take a light and pass it through, pass it under the fillet. So you got the skin side down, and you want to pass a flashlight or something or a headlamp under it and look for the worms. Pull them out. Don't throw the fillet out because it's got a couple of worms, but you don't want to eat that if you're eating the fish raw. That's what I do. I'm crazy about this. I have friends who think I'm insane. They don't candle any of their fillets. They eat everything completely raw and they never check it, but that's not me. The thought of having a worm burrowing into my stomach lining is just, that's not something that I really want to deal with.
No, I think a lot of people would not. I should point out the book is not all words. I mean, tell us about the collaboration with the Leighton Kelly with this wonderful artwork.
Yeah, Leighton, I've known Leighton since my hippie days as a crazy sort of avant-garde musician playing music on the streets. And Leighton was equally eccentric, artistic type. But everything that I ever saw Leighton do as an artist, I always felt like it belonged in a museum, from the papier-mâché mask to the paintings of ceilings to murals that he did. And I long wanted to collaborate with him. And then, the offer to make this book came along from Heyday. They just sort of called me out of the blue and they said, why don't you do this book? And I said, sure. And I said, I have the artist. And they have like a staff of really great artists. And they said, well, usually we go with our own people. I said, I really want you to see some of the drawings that Leighton can do and then tell me what you think. And so he submitted like a picture of a clam. I believe it was a gaper clam. And a picture of a ghost shrimp. And they were so blown away by those two pictures. They said, that's our guy. And then Leighton really helped. He put a lot of input into the design of the book. And if I may, I know I'm sort of going on here, but it's one of my favorite stories about the book is that, I'm sort of a fish nerd, and you might have guessed.
Yeah.
But In any case, one of my favorite books about intertidal life forms was written by Ed Ricketts, who was the principal character in John Steinbeck's Cannery Row. And there's a great book by Ed Ricketts, who's an esteemed marine biologist. And he wrote this book called Between Pacific Tides with Jack Calvin. And it's a wonderful study of intertidal life forms, you know, tide pool creatures, written in the 1930s. Now, what I've written is a fishing and foraging book with, you know, stories and poems. It's not a serious scientific study, although there are scientific details in it. The thing that I really wanted this, I really wanted my book to look like the first edition of Between Pacific Tides, because that first edition with the hardcover and the little green waves and the sea creatures, all drawn so beautifully, it was just a thing of great beauty to behold. And I kind of wanted my book to look like that. And when I started working with Leighton, I told him this, and I said, you know, as a sort of governing concept for the look of the book, I want it to look like a book called Between Pacific Tides. Have you heard of it? And now this is, 10 years after I've known Leighton, and I've been discussing this project with him for a long time. And Leighton just suddenly goes, oh, yeah, I have a copy of it sitting right here on my desk. And I said, that's kind of weird, since you're not like a fisherman, you're not a tide pooler, to my knowledge. And he goes, no, but my grandfather did all the artwork.
Really?
So Leighton Kelly's grandfather was Richie Lovejoy, who did all of the line drawings in Between Pacific Tides, which is the book that I wanted my book to look like. So this coincidence occurred. You know, it was like one of these aha moments. And then suddenly I realized that the universe really wanted this book to happen.
And there it is. It's called The Sea Forager's Guide to the Northern California Coast. Kirk Lombard is the author. He is the co-founder with his wife Camila of Sea Forager in San Francisco. It's a community-supported fishery providing sustainable seafood and provides tours so people can learn how to catch their own seafood. He is the author. Leighton Kelly, as you heard, is the illustrator. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 to talk about seafood generally, or maybe some individual experiences you've had trying to obtain seafood yourself. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So at the beginning of the book, Kirk, you rave about well-being in Denmark, and you give credit to small fish. Which are the fish we're talking about here, and how can California copy that example?
Well, I run a, like you were saying, I run this seafood delivery service where I'm trying to focus on sustainably caught seafood. So I source stuff from all over the coast, and I try to favor small-time fishermen with little boats that are fishing hook and line. But I also get a lot of small fish, and I it's like sort of a pet peeve of mine. I did a TEDx talk on the glories of small fish, and it's a tough sell in North America, I think. You know, it's funny. You go all over the world, and you go to southern Italy or southern Europe, and people love to eat small fish. You go to northern Europe, people love to eat small fish. I think Africa, there's a tradition of that. I think in the Middle East, there's a tradition, like everywhere, really, all over the world. But in North America, people want, typically, I'm not saying everybody, but typically people want a big slab of meat on the plate that doesn't have any bones in it. And when you think about all of the nutritious aspects of eating lower on the food chain, so you're typically talking about species of fish that are higher in the omega-3s that everybody's always raving about, and lower in all the toxins because they don't live long enough to bioaccumulate them. And when you think about things like anchovies or herring or sardines, mackerel, these fish are designed by nature to resist a certain degree of predation, a certain degree of large predation, because everything in the ocean, except for, you know, mainstream American seafood consumers, seems to want to eat small fish. So they've had to evolve survival strategies that allow them to reproduce like flies, essentially. And so just on that level, those fish would be the ones that are more sustainable to harvest. Now, there's also problems with over-harvest when you start catching those fish to turn them into pellets to feed other fish. I don't think that anyone really recognizes that as a sustainable practice, and that seems to be what's going on largely with the small forage fishes on this planet. it's an unfortunate development. However, at least in California, and especially in my section of California, I'm in the general in the sort of San Francisco Bay Area. I live south of there, but that's the general region that I'm in. In our area, there's no excuse because these fish are often ones that you could just catch using a totally legal casting net and throwing it off of a local pier. We have jacks. We have several species of silversides, jacksmelt, top smelt. We have mackerel, Pacific mackerel. We have jack mackerel. We have surf smelt. We have night smelt. We have anchovies. We have sardines. And these are all open on a recreational level, so people can just buy a license and actually go and catch these fish and eat them themselves. And the I try to encourage people to do that rather than always thinking that, that what they need to be eating is a big slab of meat from an alpha predator fish that lived a long time, bioaccumulated a lot of toxins, and might not be as sustainable as the others. Again, I'm rambling on and on here. I could talk on this subject for hours.
I want to come up on that point though a little more about the idea of eating lower on the food chain because then you're eating animals with shorter lives without as much accumulation of potential toxins from pollution.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, there's one great exception to this, of course, is salmon. You know, the salmon is its life cycle is so short that typically salmon don't live long enough to bioaccumulate the toxins that one typically associates with larger fish. But beyond that, you know, if you're eating a sardine or an anchovy, you're eating something that hasn't lived long enough to bioaccumulate those toxins. Although in some cases, I guess if you're eating them out of the inner harbor in Richmond, California, or, you know, Ventura or something, that might be a problem. But on the whole, the smaller fish, the smaller schooling fishes are the ones that are going to be, they're also, you know, they're eating lower down on the food chain, so they're not getting that sort of cascade of toxins that trickles down with fish that eat only other fish. So there's multiple reasons why, just on a health level, it would be a good idea. I'm not saying that people should replace their halibut steaks with anchovies, for God's sakes, but they might want to just sample anchovies every now and then. The oceans will appreciate it, and your body will appreciate it.
Kirk Lombard's our guest on The Exchange. He's the author of The Sea Forager's Guide to the Northern California Coast, illustrated by Leighton Kelly. So what's a good start for someone who's got no particular fishing skills to begin with?
Well, if you have absolutely no, like if you're starting from scratch, I think the first thing to realize is that it's not going to be easy. I mean, like I said, you know, I give these tours and I take people out and I throw a net in herring season and it comes up loaded with herring and everybody's hooing and awing, and then I get a call a week later and this person saying, hey, I took your class, but I'm not catching anything. What's going on here? And it's like, well, are you paying attention to where the birds are diving? Did you look at the tide book to see that it was the same tide that it was on the day that I went out? Are you looking around for herring boats? Are you calling all your friends to find out where the school is spawning? For people who just are starting fishing and have never done that, they got to realize that it's a lifelong passion and study to actually go out and catch something. So that would be the first thing I'd say. But then beyond that, just pay attention to what's going on. Ask questions. Look at the water, and familiarize yourself with what's local. And that's the beginning. There's no like, oh, you take this lure, put it on here, walk down to the water and start cat. I mean, there's a whole system of things that. I mean, the fishermen who are listening to this right now are laughing. Because I'm like trying to describe fishing, you know, and it's a big subject. And so it's like you're brand new to it. Just be advised that it's normal not to catch anything. That's my first thing.
Okay. You mentioned herring and trying to catch them. And you mentioned in the book that people should always check out a herring spawn. I mean, what's so fascinating about them and where do they find them?
Well, in our area, it's a Northern California deal here, and I'm not really sure about the Oregon coast, but I do know in our area, San Francisco Bay is like a mecca for herring. It's a huge spawn, although this last year was one of the smallest spawns we've seen, according to the data collected by the best science available, which we get through the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. It was a pretty small spawn. I'm not sure why. But typically going up the coast, the herring will spawn in Tomales Bay. I think they spawn in Humboldt Bay. They're used to anyway. And, you can, get herring in the winter, but it's not like, okay, so you know that herring are spawning in Tomales Bay. I'm going to go to Tomales Bay on Monday and I'm just going to start throwing my net and I'm going to catch herring. So what that would mean is you would have to go up there. You'd have to get your binoculars out. You'd have to search the shoreline. You'd have to look for gulls pecking on the rocks to see if there's been a recent spawn activity. Well, the reason that we can catch herring in the winter is because they come in to spawn. And when they come in to spawn, they spawn in shallow water, and you can get a net down on them. And that's really the only reason that they are catchable.
All right, Emily mentions having seen them in Crescent City Harbor, so they are certainly up close to the American border.
I can't believe I missed that one. Yes, of course.
All right, Kirk Lombard's our guest, the Sea Forager's Guide to the Northern California Coast. Back with Kirk and you in a minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Kirk Lombard from Sea Forager in San Francisco, which provides community-supported fishery. It's a subscription service for seafood, just like people do for CSA's community-supported agriculture. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about Kirk's book, The Sea Forager's Guide to the Northern California Coast, illustrated by Leighton Kelly. We're talking about all kinds of things you can pull from the sea sustainably and feed yourself with. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You had mentioned anchovies in the previous segment. This is another small fish that most people just know as the thing they don't want on a pizza. Take us beyond the wrap. What are the good things about anchovies?
It's funny because there's a couple of boats down here that have been catching anchovies, and we've just been really lucky because the anchovies this year are just monstrous. I mean, they're like the size of a friggin' smelt, you know, which is, well, I don't know if that really, I don't know how many people are familiar with smelt, but a smelt-sized anchovy, man, that's so big you should get it stuffed and hung on your wall, you know.
10 inches is really big for an anchovy, right?
Yeah, so like we're getting these big anchovies, and you know, you can do a whole process called a la bocarones, which is when you cure them. It's a little bit labor-intensive because even a big anchovy, you know. When you're filleting it, it's like the best way to do it is I don't know if you want all this information, but
yeah, go ahead.
You debone them by pulling the spine out, and there's a very easy way to do that.
Is this the one where you can grab the head and pull?
Yeah, and then you you soak them in a vinegar solution with water and vinegar, and then you leave them, and then you pack them in oil. Oh, sorry, you salt them, and then you pack them in oil, and you leave them for a few days, and they're just so amazing. My wife's been doing this, so we've been doing a la bocarones on the anchovies, and it's just really, I don't know. I guess some people reject fish that taste like a fish. I think a lot of people want fish that have sort of a bland, sort of a neutral taste. But if you're into like fish that actually taste like a fish, and I think a lot of people who are into that will know what I'm talking about, then I think anchovies are for you. And you know, you have to be careful with them, of course, because anchovies are filter feeders, and in years where you have high PSP counts in the water and the domoic acid that we're all familiar with from our crab debacle this last year, you have to be careful eating anchovies. In California, the health department has a hotline that you can call to find out if there's been high domoic acid counts. It's an 800 number, 800-553-4133 is that number. And you can always call that if you're going clamming or catching filter feeding fish species, just to keep yourself at ease. before you go and you feed your whole family on this kind of stuff.
All right. We have another another call with information or a question about just the sort of things we're talking about, the health concerns. Here's Val in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kirk Lombard.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on accumulation of mercury in older fish, and that might be an issue. I always like to catch small fish just for that reason, because they're younger and don't have as much mercury.
All right. Thanks for the idea there, Val. And so what about mercury accumulation? Is that an issue for some of the smaller fish you're talking about?
It's an issue for all fish, but it's less of an issue for fish that live a shorter lifespan and feed lower on the food chain. So typically, you know, at the same time, there are going to be exceptions. There's a site, it's called the OEHHA, the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, and it's a California-based site. But in there is a incredible chart that covers all of the popularly caught and consumed fish species on the California coast. And it will tell you how safe it is to eat them. And this is, I guess, the toxins that they're looking at are heavy metals, mostly. So it's a very good rubric by which to judge whether you're going to be safe eating the fish. In response to that caller's question, not his question, but his statement about trying to keep the smaller fish, I think that that's really cool and an awesome thing, as long as you're keeping a fish that's smaller but also legal in size. But I do want to point out that, you've been out all day long floating around in your kayak and you haven't gotten a single bite, and then you hook into a 30-pound California halibut, which is a big old fish that's probably accumulated some toxins. Now, are you saying you're going to throw that fish back? I mean, boy, that's a better fisherman than me. I mean, I don't know. I would have a trouble making that decision. You know, it's fine if you're like in the fish, you're catching a lot of fish. Okay, so throw the big ones back. But some of us, you've been out there for 12 hours, you get one fish and it happens to be 40 pounds. You're probably going to take that home, right?
Mm-hmm. No doubt. So all the technique is in here, and we have jigs and lures and nets and sabikis and all kinds of things in here. But beyond all that, Kirk, it sounds like it's more than food. It's spiritual for you.
Yeah, I always shy away from saying that because I want to sort of resist my my inner hippie or something, you know. But I can't, because it really is for me that, you know, when I'm away for too long from the tide pools that I love so much, I just get weird. I start getting antsy. And I think, people who embrace this kind of stuff feel that too. It's like going to church, going down to the shore to pick some seaweeds or to turn over a rock and find a midshipman, which is a fish I used to use for bait, but I no longer do. Or the occasional clamming trip. These things are just, for some of us, just really important aspect I hate using that word, but because it's so overused. But yeah, there's a spiritual quality to that. I guess I have to admit it.
Force you to get in touch with your inner hippie. So you mentioned going down to the tide pools. What kinds of things do you find in the tide pools that are edible?
A lot of my trips to tide pools, and I hope I can make this clear, are not always out foraging trips. A lot of times I just like to go and look. And I love to go with my son, and we just... we wait around. There's a great marine reserve down here, and the tide pool life is just so awesome. There's a variety of different types of sculpins. There's sea anemones, and there's bat stars and sun stars, and all these different seaweeds. I've been sort of quizzing him lately on his different seaweeds, so he knows Turkish washcloth. He's 3 years old, by the way.
Mm-hmm. He knows all this already.
Yeah, he can identify, like, seriously, like 25 different species of animals that live in, animals and plants that live in tide pools. But in any case, yeah, I guess that's just part of the deal if you're going to grow up in this family. But as far as like going down to tide pools, there's stuff that can be foraged if you're in the right area, and it's not a closed area. They have a lot of closed rocky shoreline in California due to the MPA, and we have areas where you can harvest stuff. And in those areas, you know, I'm known to pick mussels or to gather up my nori. Or to poke pole, which is a technique of fishing wherein one pushes a baited stick under a hole in a rock in order to try to catch the elusive monkey face eel. But more often than not lately, I've been getting cabazon and greenling, which I'm not so keen on, but I get a lot of cabazon, greenling, and rockfish, grass rockfish, in these holes under rocks. So yeah, so that, those are the things. But I just wanted to make it clear that I'm not always down there to forage. A lot of times I just like to go down and look.
Just a visit, yeah, okay. Well, okay, now you've also answered the question about where the monkey face news name came from. It's from the monkey face eel, good to know. While we're standing here at the edge of the ocean, Grumpy John at Grants Pass wants to know, how do you identify edible kelp?
You know, it's a good question. There's a couple of really good books out there, and if you get my book, you can look in the bibliography. I think I have a couple of them listed. But you know, it's hard because here's the problem. The problem is that there's a lot of different names for them, and so you have to kind of go with the Latin names for things. And then a lot of seaweeds how can I explain this? So if somebody says to me, how do I identify a halibut? Well, that's pretty easy, right? Or how do I identify a striped bass? Like, that's easy. But how do I tell the difference between Turkish washcloth and Turkish towel?
Uh-huh.
Well, one's smaller than the other one, and one has less of a large sort of leaf-like structure. But first you have to find those things, and first, you have to find them and identify them. So if that person's asking that question, I can give them some names and they can look them up. So you want to the most popular, you know what I'm doing right now is I'm opening my own book.
Uh-huh.
How do you feel about that?
That's great. That's why you have to go back for a refresher course.
I'm not too good on my Latin, so I have to look in my own book to get it, but.
Right, but so the fact is that stuff like bullwhip kelp is edible, right?
Okay, so bullwhip kelp is a kelp species that's really easy to identify. Bullwhip kelp is that big, long kelp that looks like a bullwhip, and it's got a big, round ball on the end. That ball is actually a float that helps the thing stay aloft. And the leaves, if you're lucky enough to find bull kelp and it's washed up on a beach and it's not, like, turning crusty and brown and kind of gross with kelp flies all over it, but is rather kind of green and fresh looking, and when you bend it, it snaps. That's an edible, and it makes for a great pickle. So bullwhip kelp, you can actually cut the stalk of the kelp into little circular chunks, then make your favorite quick pickle recipe, drop them in there, and they'll be ready to eat in a day and a half or 2 days.
Wow.
And that species, you can look it up. That's the most easily identifiable of all the kelps. And we're calling that Nereocystis lutkiana. And I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong. But it's bullwhip kelp. And then, you know, you have kombu, which is Laminaria satchelli. You have rockweed. Now, rockweed is also known as fucus. And it's...
Yeah, be careful pronouncing that.
It's very good for your thyroid. Okay, but it's not my favorite of seaweeds.
Right, well, like sea lettuce, for example. I mean, can you actually use it like you use lettuce that grows on land?
Well, no. What I've ever done with sea lettuce is I take it and I spread it out on a screen in my backyard when there's sun. I live in a very foggy area, but and then you just let it dry, and then it dries like nori, and then I crumble it up and I put it in seaweed. I actually mix it with nori. And put it in soups and and chowders and stuff like that. It just adds a little salty oceanic flavor. But sea lettuce is known as ulva, and there's a number of different species of ulva. They also call it green laver. And it's all over the coast of California, at least, and I assume in Oregon, too. And then there's nori, which is various species of pyropia. And that's the real deal. That's probably the most famous because nori is the stuff that's used in California rolls and everything else. And as I mentioned, Turkish towel and Turkish washcloth, you can make a great, very good pudding and ice cream out of those because the red algaes have pterygium in them, which gets goopy when you boil it and cook it down, and you can make stocks and ice creams and like I said, pudding out of it.
Wow. Kirk, how old were you when you started fishing? I mean, I'm curious to know when your own seafood collection began.
I grew up in New York City, okay? I grew up in West Village. My parents were in the theater, and we lived in a housing project for artists. And I lived directly across the street from the Hudson River, which was sort of a doomed body of water back then.
Yeah.
But I spent every day of my life catching eels and catching striped bass and bluefish in the Hudson River. And that's where it started. It was my grandfather introduced me to fishing.
Wow. It's come a long way since then. And now you run Sea Forager in San Francisco and are the author of The Sea Forager's Guide to the Northern California Coast. Leighton Kelly provided the illustrations. Great fun talking to you, Kirk Lombard. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's nice to be on here.
All right, take care.